It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
My daughter was a year and a half when he went to prison, and she's six now. We drive from Texas to Oklahoma pretty much every single week.
Kristen Slough's husband, Paul, is one of four Blackwater security guards accused of opening fire on Iraqi civilians in 2007. He's been in prison for 4 years.
We're really hopeful that they'll take a look at it and say, you know what, this doesn't make sense.
Former Army Green Beret Matthew Goldstein has been charged with premeditated murder of an unarmed Afghan man suspected of being a bomb maker. Last December, the president tweeted, "I will be reviewing the case of a U.S. military hero." Goldstein has admitted the killing, but his wife has conducted a very public campaign in his defense.
Did your husband assassinate this suspected bomb maker?
Assassinate? No. My husband took care of an enemy combatant who did harm and was planning to do harm, more harm.
At a town hall last night, presidential candidate Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who served as a lieutenant in the U.S. Navy Reserve, said pardoning those who had been tried by a jury of their peers is a mistake.
Other U.S. service members in a legal proceeding determined that they had committed crimes. That is undermining the foundation of American moral authority.
At least two of the cases now under review have not yet gone to trial, which means the president would be rendering a judgment before all the facts have been introduced as evidence. David Martin, CBS News, The Pentagon.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. That is actually a pretty current report. And what you might not know is that there are way too many soldiers who have been incarcerated, who have been charged with crimes on the battlefield. Not that soldiers are not capable of committing crimes on a battlefield. It's war, after all. But many of them have been convicted under the ridiculous, horrific rules of engagement put in place by the Obama military after he was elected in 2008. And many of them were, you know, murder is what you do on the battlefield. Killing is what you do. That's what you do with enemies. You're taught and trained to do that. But many of these young men have been caught up in the military rules of engagement and have been accused and convicted. And some of them have spent years and years in prison already. And let me just tell you that there are people in Congress who have been interceding on their behalf now for quietly, while you didn't even know about this, and neither did I. There's actually a caucus now called Justice for Warriors, and it has members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. And so we are beginning to see some things happen. We're beginning to hear the president talk about maybe issuing pardons. You probably heard the Pentagon push back and talk about how horrible that would be. You just heard the CBS report on that. But we today are going to really look at this situation, and we're going to do it in a very personal and powerful way. I want to introduce to you Sergeant Derek Miller. Derek was a U.S. Army National Guardsman. He has just been released from Leavenworth. He was released in May, on the 20th of May, after being convicted for the death of a civilian during his third deployment to Afghanistan. That was his third deployment. Sergeant Miller says that the civilian attempted to grab his weapon, and he fatally shot the civilian in self-defense. We're going to get into that. But he was sentenced to life in prison, but now he's out on parole, and he has agreed to talk to us today about his life, his time in prison, and what happened on that battlefield in Afghanistan. Sergeant Miller, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to America and tell a story of the American soldier, that what we go through on the battlefield and, unfortunately, what we have to go through from the military justice system.
Yeah. Let's go back in time a little bit, Derek. Were you from Maryland originally? I know you're in Maryland now, but was that your home state?
Yeah, I was born and raised right here in Prince George's County, and I grew up in Frederick and Montgomery County. So, yeah,
all right.
This is home for me.
Yep, I see it in my mind's eye. I know it very well. So when you enlisted back in 2010, right? Is that when you enlisted?
Yes. Yes, ma'am. I enlisted back in 2006. That was, the moment that I thought that everything for me came into alignment. I had just lost my job as a construction crew chief. I was in charge of a crew of guys, and we installed kitchens and baths, and I got laid off, unfortunately. And I looked at my wife and my kids, and I didn't know how I was going to provide for them. And basically, my love for country and my desire to provide for my family came into alignment with me joining the Maryland Army National Guard, and everything was moving along perfectly. It was a great fit for me.
Yeah. Let me ask you, I think I know the answer to this, but is it unusual? I think it became more common for National Guard to be deployed in combat overseas. I don't think we saw that before entanglement in the Middle East, but speak to that for just a second. Is that different for regular enlistees? How does that work?
Sure. I think normal enlistees, guys who are actually in active duty Army, tend to have a rotation, a type of schedule that their units kind of keep them on for deployment. In the National Guard, you can be called up at any time, basically for a disaster within the state. You can volunteer to go with a unit, maybe, possibly a sister unit that you know. So you have, family members who are in a different state and they're about to deploy. You can get online and basically register and volunteer to go help anybody who is deploying. So it is, in my experience, more common for National Guard soldiers to be able and deployed either in the states or overseas.
So I think way back when, National Guard troops maybe didn't quite have the same training. But I'm guessing that's not true anymore. So correct me. I mean, do you guys get the same rigorous training as regular enlisted troops?
Absolutely. I mean, we go through the same basic and the specialized MOS training as the normal Army soldiers. And basically, the bottom line is that we can go to Air Assault School, Ranger School, all the other specialized units that the active Army goes to. And then you couple that with the fact that we can deploy as fast as any or faster than active duty units. So our training is actually very intense. And then you couple that with having a normal civilian life. So you're really bringing those two fields together.
It's kind of hard, I would think. I always, maybe you would disagree as someone who served in combat, but during Vietnam, you may know or you may not know that the soldiers were like shipped out and went to Hawaii to meet their wives for like a 2-week break. And I always thought that in some ways that I wondered if that was really wise. I know when my father went to World War II, he was gone for 3 years. He was just gone, which was hard.
Yeah.
But it was like he was focused and in the mode and not like ripped out of a war zone and taken to Hawaii. I don't know. How do you feel about that? Do you think that break in between was a good thing to go back home to normal, so-called normal life, or do you think it made it harder?
For me, I felt like the experience was better. I could kind of have that good balance between having a, family life, spending time with my kids, and a civilian career, rather than being active the whole time and then trying to get out and figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life. Hopefully I would have something lined up. So I felt like having those two moving, in unison, I was able to plan for my future better. But looking back in hindsight, I was in for 4 years before I was court-martialed, and I was deployed for 3 out of those 4 years. Now, 2 of those deployments I volunteered for, and that was on me. But looking back now, I wish I had that time with my kids back. I wish I had that time to strengthen my marriage and really work on, the family aspect. But, hindsight's always 20/20. At the time, I really felt like I was able to balance both and move forward. So.
Derek, I would just unsolicited advice from me. The thing about it is great men of all stripes who are called to do great things don't usually have on their resume a lot of family time. I think of people, because you can't really have both. I think you've paid a great price, and we're going to get into that. But I just think that's a reality. I would want to know, you said you were over construction projects. What did you do? What was your assignment in Afghanistan?
What did I do in construction or what did I do in Afghanistan?
No, in Afghanistan. What was your job in Afghanistan then?
So my job in Afghanistan, I was a squad leader of a infantry unit. We were kicking in doors and pulling out bad guys. We were responsible for patrolling battle space. We had really one of the hottest zones in our province up in Nuristan, which is on the border of Pakistan. Our base was built into like a fishbowl of mountains. So throughout the night, we would constantly be getting RPGs, mortars, and machine gun fire. That happened consistently over about a six-month span where we had guys who were moving, you know, either to do their job or maintenance their truck or getting prepared for missions, and mortars would come in and we would have soldiers wounded, being flown out. It was really a very hot area that we were stationed in. So our job was to try to make that safe for the Afghan people and conduct military operations. We were a very small unit. We're a heavy weapons unit. So we typically traveled with less bodies than a normal light infantry unit. So that caused us some issues with trying to control the Taliban insurgency in those areas. I mean, there are some valleys we wouldn't even be able to go into because they would have Taliban flags flying proudly. And we had to have close air support to be able to go into those valleys. So the area was just very hot and very intense fighting.
You know, I have to say, and we'll get into this more later, but I've heard such nightmare stories about the rules of engagement. And it just stands to reason that if you are trying to work with the Afghans and fight others of the Afghans, and you're from another country, another language, the ability to discern who you can trust and who you can't is just not something you can reduce to a simple formula. Would just like your comments on that. What kind of a challenge was that?
I completely agree. It is almost impossible. I mean, people sit in offices hundreds and thousands of miles away and come up with policies about what should be happening on the ground by the soldiers. It sounds really good in a briefing when you put rules for combat, but it only works when both sides are following rules. When you have civilian, you know, being used as shields, or insurgents dropping their weapons and changing their clothes to blend in with the civilian population, and then you essentially handcuff your soldiers who are in the fight, who recognize, who see the people who were just shooting at them minutes before, and now you have to figure out whether, if I fire at this guy, am I going to go to jail? You know in your heart that that man will be back on the battlefield tomorrow. He'll in place an IED in the road and blow up somebody's son or daughter later on that evening. It is virtually impossible for us to win a war fighting under the confines of the ROE that the soldiers are under today. It's an impossible burden for a soldier who is on the ground in a shifting, dynamic battlefield where the enemy is very intelligent. They can go online and look up some of the rules that U.S. soldiers have to follow in combat.
Derek,
how possibly is that fair?
You don't have to convince me. So this is your third or fourth deployment. I'm sorry. Remind me.
That was my third deployment.
All right. So how did you feel that? And again, I want to get back to a more detailed discussion of the rules of engagement in just a little bit here. But how have the rules changed between your first deployment and this third deployment? And actually, I hear the music, so you're going to have to answer that question on the other side. Then also, my guest is Derek Miller, Sergeant Derek Miller, who just was released from Leavenworth, pardoned. He was there serving a life sentence for killing an Afghani. And we're going to talk about that. In fact, Derek, I'm going to ask you to go back to that day and tell us what happened. So please stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
You have overzealous prosecutors. You've had people, Matt Goldstein's been on this show, Eddie Gallagher's wife, Eddie Gallagher's trial is going on right now.
Today?
I mean, you had somebody in Eddie Gallagher's case say that he's the one that did it. And the trial is still going on.
Prosecution
that's,
witness.
That's insane. The prosecutor's witness. Right. So what you have is you have overzealous prosecutors. You have an investigative service that's corrupt, if not unlawful, within the U.S. military. And then the actual trial itself, it's almost criminal what they're allowed to do to these defendants. Right. So you have this all over the military, Navy, Army, Marine Corps, and we want to put a stop to it. And President Trump brought this up saying he might start pardoning these guys. So what we want to do in Congress is point out cases like this and be able to present to President Trump, here's these cases that we have vetted, here's the people, here's what's going on, take a look at these cases, because right. You can't trust the military to check themselves on this. This takes somebody else. That's what Congress is for. That's what UAP is for.
Isn't it interesting to me? That's Congressman Duncan Hunter talking across, of course, obviously, before Eddie Gallagher did receive a verdict of not guilty, which was pretty amazing. But just an aside for a second, Duncan Hunter Jr. is currently in Congress. I feel like I know him, even though I don't. He's certainly under fire right now for his own problems. But let me tell you this, his dad, Duncan Hunter Sr., used to be a frequent guest of mine when I did radio. And then when I moved to D.C., I got to know him personally. And Congressman Duncan Hunter Sr., I will never forget him talking about his son leaving his very high-paid job after 9/11 and just going across the street and signing up. So Duncan Hunter Jr. Served the country faithfully and honorably, as far as I can tell. And now he is throwing his hat in the ring to help these many warriors who have done things on the battlefield and have then later been convicted in military courts and in civilian courts, as is the case of Blackwater, convicted of a murder, and as in Derek's case, sentenced to life at Leavenworth, life in prison for what he did on the battlefield. So Derek Miller is our guest, and Derek, if you just tuned in, has been just released from Leavenworth after 8 years. They're spending 8 years of a life sentence. Derek, I had asked you a question before the break, so let's answer that one quickly before we go on to your actual story. I ask you if the rules of engagement had changed significantly between your first deployment in Afghanistan and your third one.
And thank you again for having me. They absolutely have. If you look at my first deployment back in 2006, they had a tactic the Taliban would use to emplace cameras and film convoys coming through, where they would, you know, make these propaganda videos where you'd see, you know, a couple Humvees coming by and shoot up in the air in a ball of fire, and, you know, the Arabic writing underneath with the black Taliban flag. We were told in 2006 that if we ever saw someone filming our convoy, that we were authorized to fire. That was a tactic that we learned and we knew was going to result in U.S. casualties. In 2010, my third deployment, we were told that absolutely under no circumstances, unless we were fired upon and we could clearly identify and there was no threat to civilian casualties, then we could engage. It got so bad that after they changed the rules of engagement, they would set up cameras in the same buildings or in high up buildings. And as we traverse our, you know, heavy machine guns to at least defend ourselves, at least identify and point at the threat, they were running piano wire across the Humvees at defilade, where the gunners would shift their line of fire and essentially get beheaded by these piano wires that they couldn't see because they were facing in the wrong directions. They learn our tactics, they learn our ROEs, and they adjust. Unfortunately, the rules of engagement are not allowing the soldiers to adjust and fight.
I tell you, Derek, almost nothing makes me more angry than the stories I've heard. And of course, I'll just drop in the whole business about the, I don't know if you experienced this, where the Afghan leaders would bring little boys in because our soldiers were trying to partner with Afghan soldiers, and their leaders were also in the same compound, and they would at night, in some cases, bring in these young boys to have sex, because that's not uncommon. It's very common in Islamic culture. They don't call it homosexuality, but it is. And so they would bring them in. And I remember one soldier of ours, just who could not bear to hear the sounds of these little boys, the screaming, and tried to intercede. And the rules of engagement would not let them do that, would not let them help these little boys who were being abused. This is how bad it is. And this is the groundwork I want to lay for Derek's story. So, Derek, take us back to that day or that night and just tell us the story of what happened that fateful night.
Absolutely. This is back in 2010. I am on month 10 or 11 of a 12-month deployment. So we're very close to coming home. You can see a light in a tunnel. You know your daughters and your wife are on the other side, and we're really looking forward to just not being shot at and being able to enjoy, normal civilian life. We were tasked to go recover military assets. The Afghan army left the base to conduct a patrol, which they are not supposed to do without coalition forces. It's supposed to be doing operations so we can provide security and, quote, train the Afghan soldiers as they go through their area. That didn't happen. They left the wire. They were ambushed by the Taliban, and essentially they ran away from their trucks, leaving M16s, 50 cal machine guns, radio equipment, all types of secure, material that the U.S. Army had given to the Afghan army. So Operation Iron Locust, the first iteration, was kicked off to recover those assets. This valley that we had to go into was essentially one way in, one way out. You can see anyone coming from miles out, and that's exactly what happened. The only area that the helicopters had to land was basically mined. There were IEDs put in, and there was a complex ambush on the coalition forces there. Unfortunately, a U.S. soldier lost their life, and the air went black. Essentially, a sandstorm came in, and they weren't allowed to fly anymore. Luckily, those pilots, you had the guts to basically defy orders and go and recover those soldiers who were pinned down. They flew in, they fought their way out, and the Taliban essentially continued to have the equipment that we wanted and needed back. So Operation Iron Locust kicked off the second iteration. This is the one that I was a part of. We were tasked with being a support by fire, basically mortars and artillery to support the soldiers who were on the ground just in case the air went black and they couldn't get close air support. We were there to make sure that they had everything that they needed. So in the process of planning out that mission, we were told that guys were kicking in doors and pulling people out. They were blowing stuff up, and a real fight combat was going on. Most of the civilian traffic was headed in the opposite direction. They knew bad stuff was happening, and they wanted to be out of the area. We received intel probably about an hour into the mission that there was going to be a convoy of vehicles, probably 4 to 3 trucks moving into the valley to plus up the fighters who were getting beat up. No less than 30 minutes after we received that report, 3 vehicle convoy, all military age males, tried to infiltrate the valley. We had the only traffic control point, the only road in, the only road out. We pulled those guys out, began going through their stuff. We found AK-47s, bandoliers of ammunition, 55-gallon drums. They were empty. Usually those are used for like homemade explosive. They pack them full and then stick them in culvert pipes or pack them in the road to blow up any U.S. vehicles. So when we had found those items, we also found changes of clothes, like civilian garb, and then also we found a laptop computer, which is highly irregular for Afghanistan. It's hard to find people with running water and consistent electricity. So to find a laptop computer was really raising a lot of red flags for us. We also started going through their IDs, and they were really shoddy. It looked like they were possibly made on that computer. I thought we had everything that we needed to detain the individuals. The senior NCO on the ground made the call to go ahead and let those guys go into the valley. He said, in his opinion, we didn't have enough to detain them.
Oh, boy.
So we ended up... What's that mean?
I just said, oh, boy.
Yeah.
So you had to let them go.
Yeah, we had to let those guys go into the valley. And, it was that feeling of dread that you know these guys are up to no good. We ended up relocating and passing off that traffic control point onto another unit. So we relocated to a nearby vacated property where we could set up a really good mortar position, and we had complete 360 security around our position. That next day, the driver of the lead truck and two of the military-age males approached the southern side of our perimeter. The driver approached the Afghan army guys and sat down and had tea. The two military-age males separated and went opposite directions around our perimeter. After probably about 15, 20 minutes of conversating with the Afghan army, the senior NCO on the southern side, basically the crew chief of the mortar team, told the driver of the lead vehicle, I guess he did not recognize him, that, look, there's a military operation going on and he needed to leave the area. The message was relayed. You know, he got up and gathered his things and he left. In the process, he was asking questions of the Afghan army guys, how long we're going to be there, what they're up to. And after he was told to leave, he took that information, God knows where. Probably less than 45 minutes later, probably an hour later, he came to the northern side where my truck was positioned, and my gunner recognized him, as well as myself, as the driver of the lead vehicle from the truck the day before. We asked him, look, you need to leave the area. There's a military operation going on. You can't be here. After he had reached just the edge of our perimeter, I had that gut feeling that just something wasn't right, that just everything was reading bad about this guy. And I asked my platoon sergeant if I could detain him for further questioning. He told me, go ahead. If I didn't feel right, more than welcome to go question the guy again. I ran him down. He had walked into a nearby building. He was in there for probably about 5-10 minutes when I pulled him out. I took him over to a secure location inside of our perimeter, and with the interpreter and one other soldier providing security, I asked him, you know, what he was doing in the area. First, he told me he was an electrician here to fix, you know, power lines. I asked him where his tools were to do the job. He told me, you know, he didn't have any tools. I continued to question him about the house that he went into. I asked him, was that his home? He told me no. I asked him again, well, then what are you doing in this area? He proceeded to tell me that he was there to fix water pumps. I asked him again where his tools were to do this job, and he didn't have any. I continued to question him about, you know, what was going on? Where was the vehicle he was driving the day before? He proceeded to tell me that he couldn't drive, and I had the soldier pat him down, and we found vehicle keys in his pocket. So just nothing was matching up with this guy. Everything was really sketchy, and I asked him about the two males that were with him earlier that day, and he claimed that there was nobody with him. So at that point, I pulled my pistol. I pointed at him, and I said, look, you tell me where the attack is coming from. You tell me where the soldiers are from the day before. You tell me where all that equipment disappeared to, and you tell me all these things, I'm going to kill you. Now, my intent was not to kill him. My intent was to scare the heck out of him and get the information so I could get it to the guys who are fighting. Between relaying the message to the interpreter, the man reached up and grabbed my forearm and grabbed my pistol. I pushed through his grip and I fired one shot and I killed him. At that point, I was taken and moved to the rear. My platoon sergeant went to an elevated threat level, and probably about 30 minutes after I fired the shot, there was a complex attack on my unit. It was a horseshoe-style attack. Heavy weapons, machine guns, RPGs, and they were all landing at key points in our perimeter, our casualty collection point, where we would take anyone who would have been wounded on our entire mission, our command posts, where all of our key leaders were coordinating with the guys who were on the ground, at our mortar position, at our tow missile position. Right, these weren't just accidental locations where the heavy machine gun and the mortars were firing at. These were targeted, scouted, and executed to perfection by the enemy. They had to call in close air support to get out of the area. And my platoon sergeant, my squad leaders, everybody went to my clemency and parole board and stated that they believed that my actions that day prevented U.S. casualties.
Well, I think you actually have letters from some of the men that fought with you, beside you, stating that, Derek. But I'm assuming that you weren't arrested or charged immediately. It probably took some time. And then it's a military. Go ahead.
It did take a little bit of time. There was an initial investigation. Also, they paid $50,000 to the Afghan family before the investigation even started. It was essentially them telling them, look, we're going to take care of this. Here's some funds. We apologize for the wrongful shooting, before they even investigated who this guy was, what he was doing, and gathered all the pieces to put together in this puzzle.
And that, of course, bleeds into how the trial was conducted. And let's get to that next, Derek. I'm going to be wishing we had 2 hours, but we don't. And so I do want to talk to you. I do at least want to talk to you about your time at Leavenworth. I want to talk to you about your mother. I want to talk to you about your family. So those are the kinds of things and what people can do. Actually, if there's anything they can do, you have been paroled, not pardoned. I misstated that earlier. After a life sentence for the murder of this Afghani soldier. And by the way, Congressman Louie Gohmert, who's a very dear friend of mine, has gone to bat for Derek in a very incredible way. And so we'll get into that too. So, but we only have one segment left to do all of that, but we're going to try to do it. God bless you, Derek. Don't go away. We'll be back 15 minutes in just a second. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Not holding my children and not being able to watch them grow up for the next 2.5 years.
Chris Drotliff is thinking about freedom, his wife, his two children. The 37 months he won't be with them because he'll be in a federal prison.
And you feel like you've been railroaded.
I do.
Drotliff is quietly angry. In his only interview, Drotliff says the U.S. government was trying to appease Afghanistan and bringing him to trial.
Look, Afghanistan, this is what we'll do to people that come over there, you know, and think they have the right to do anything other than exactly what we tell them they have the right to do. That's honestly what I feel. I feel we've been used as a scapegoat.
Drotliff claimed self-defense, trying to save his own life May 9th, 2009. For the first time, in his own words, here's what happened that's sending him to prison.
A car came up behind us, got into the middle of our convoy, and struck our lead vehicle.
This was the lead vehicle. It rolled 2 or 3 times into a ditch. Drotliff thought, car bomb. The car drove off, but did a U-turn and came back.
They were coming the wrong way down Jalalabad.
Did you think they had explosives in the car?
Absolutely. I thought they had just taken our lead vehicle out, that they were back to finish the job.
The car gets closer, chaos all around. Here's the shot-up car brought to Norfolk for the trial.
We continued firing on that vehicle, and there were rounds in the back of that vehicle, but that's because as that vehicle passed us, we shot at it. After it had passed us, we continued shooting at it, because the last thing you want is a 2,000-pound explosive weapon being able to make a U-turn and get a second chance at what it just tried to do.
At trial, U.S. District Judge Robert Dumas was not sympathetic to that explanation, that the car was leaving. We can't get around the fact that all of the bullet holes were in the rear of the vehicle. It was reckless conduct, totally reckless.
All right, so that's the story of Chris Drotliff. I don't know what the update on him is, but he is just one of many who have been convicted. That was in a civilian court. Derek Miller, our guest today, was convicted in a military court. I believe, Derek, you can correct me if I'm wrong. And let me read to you what Congressman Gohmert said about Derek. It has been my honor to advocate for Sergeant Derek Miller, who appeared to have the deck stacked against him during the Obama administration, while Sergeant Miller worked passionately to defend his fellow soldiers in Afghanistan. And let me just give you two things just to make this as concise as we can, because I want you to hear all these details. During the trial, Derek's trial, there were two witnesses. There may have been more, but I'll mention two. The first witness was a soldier that originally backed up the claims made by Sergeant Miller regarding the event, the story that you just heard Derek tell. But when threatened with being named as an accessory and being placed on legal hold so that he could not demobilize, I guess that means go home, he changed his story. The other witness was an Afghan translator who was promised citizenship in the United States in exchange for his testimony. And Derek, as I understand it, witnesses that were friendly to you were not brought over by the U.S. government. Is that true?
That is very true. That is absolutely true. And you see this in cases over and over again where the government either threatens or offers favorable treatment to witnesses to change their testimony. Not to get to the heart of the truth, but to actually find people guilty. And I think it goes to the promotion system. I think it goes to the command influence, being able to select the jury members, to select the Article 32 officers, to put these people in place that they have an expectation of getting the numbers and the outcome that is expected.
I don't think there's any doubt, Derek, that since Barack Obama came into the military in 2008, that so much changed. I've never seen anything like it. We've seen massive amounts of really good men leave because they came under such pressure, whether it's people for their faith or people who were old guard soldiers who really actually believed in fighting fairly and really actually being able to fight wars and not subjecting themselves to these rules of engagement, having their men be put in danger and in not only and physically in danger, but in danger of their futures, like you being getting a life sentence and having your life really taken away from you. And so the men that weren't willing to go along with that left. So there's been a massive culture change in America's military, this push and embrace of LGBT rights, the push for Muslim rights, combatant rights in the Middle East. It's been stunning. Okay, so that brings me to this. Derek, we have not said, because it doesn't matter to me, that you are a black soldier. You know, it shouldn't matter at all, but I say that because now everybody talks about race. And so you are a black soldier who was not defended by a black caucus, the black caucus in Congress, and you were the victim of a black president who changed the culture of the military. I just wanted you to say a word about that. I don't even know if blackness has anything to do with this. Do you think it does?
I'm not sure. I've always been one of those people who looks at the individual rather than, you know, any distinct characteristic or identifying trait. But in my case, the Congressional Black Caucus did come together and write a letter in support of looking at my sentence.
That's
Elijah
good.
Cummings
that's good. I did not know that.
Yes, he did work together with Congressman Gohmert and Congressman Babin to push to fight for me to come home. That's why it's kind of concerning and, you know, a little bit disappointing that I cannot find as much bipartisan support as I would like to move forward with this Justice for Warriors caucus. It seems like a lot of good men are retreating to their corners, essentially saying that under this administration, we don't feel like we can work together to fight for other soldiers in similar combat situations like myself. And it's a shame, to the detriment of the soldiers who have to spend years, decades of their life locked up, that people would prefer to defer to their political party rather than to correctness itself.
Yeah, well, let me just go on record as saying I don't think color has anything to do with this. I think wrong positions on issues is what gets you in trouble. If you're not willing to line up with the view of the left, it doesn't matter what color you are. You are an object of derision, and you're in big trouble. And so I do think it's I think race has nothing to do with this. And so, Derek, before we get into other parts that I want to ask you about, I would like to know what you think people can do. There are a lot of military people listening. There are a lot of just plain folk listening. I know you have a Facebook, Free Derek Miller. Free Derek Miller. We'll put that on our Facebook page so that you can link to it. But is there something that they could actually do for you?
Absolutely. For all the warriors who are going through combat shootings who are in Fort Leavenworth or pending court-martial, UAP.org has a link to all of us. You can find what we're doing now, what the next step in our life is, whether we have clemency and parole boards coming up, whether we need letters of support, and also the Justice for Warriors Caucus. If you want to help, you can reach out to your local representative. Whatever state you're in, it doesn't matter. Just reach out and ask your representative to support the Justice for Warriors Caucus.
So is this
Congressman Gohmert and Duncan Hunter, Representative Gosart, Representative Perry, there's so many good men who have signed up for this caucus who are saying that there is something that is happening to the soldiers who are in combat, and we need to fight to stop this.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So we're going to put each of those things on our Facebook page so that people can link to UAP.org. They can find Justice for Warriors Caucus and read about that and see what they can do to help you in that end, too. Derek, I'm curious. You know, you spent, what, 8 years in Leavenworth? I just can't even imagine. And so I want to ask you some real personal questions now. I haven't asked you about your faith. I know because of your connection with Congressman Gohmert that you are a believer in Jesus. I know that now. But I don't know. You were 8 years in Leavenworth. Were you, when you went into Leavenworth, were you that kind of man, or did anything change in your life during those 8 years?
I was raised in a, you know, Baptist home, a Southern Baptist home. So I always had faith, and I continued to maintain that faith while I was locked up. But you lose hope. As a person who has had everything stripped from them, I've lost my home, you know, my kids, my career, both my jobs, my health care, and I'm watching my kids grow up from afar. You know, you lose hope after a while when you're constantly petitioning people to help, to send you home, to fight for your friends, to fight for what you believe is right, and just nothing's happening. No motion is that you can perceive is going on. So after 8 years, yeah, I lost hope a few times, but I never lost faith. Faith in God was primarily what helped me get through, and love for my children and my mom, and just trying to get back to them.
Tell us about your mom, because I know she was a big part of this whole process.
Absolutely. My mom was an amazing woman, and I know that having me go away and be locked up and be in combat was extremely stressful for her. She was, I'm an only child, so I'm her baby. I'm still her baby, if you ask her.
I know that. I have a son. I have a son who, yes, he does not like me thinking of him as my baby, but I still do.
Yes, and she always will. And yep. I gladly take on that role. And she was, you know, diligent about going to knock on doors. And once, you know, she and Congressman Gohmert got together, it was, you know, a perfect pairing. Because he was just as passionate as my mom was. They both worked together and kept in contact. His office is amazing. Everybody in his office just put in hours and hard time and writing letters and finding out when my parole and clemency date was, and just being present at every moment to, one, help my mom, you know, get that peace that she knew that she wasn't alone, and two, fighting the legal process to get a resolution that ultimately resulted in me coming home. So my mom is just one of those people who, when the chips are down, you can count on. And she was definitely an amazing woman and a big part of me coming home. And I thank her and I love her and I thank God for every day.
You know, Derek, I think one of the greatest testimonies to your faith, honestly, I heard you in a briefing in D.C. a couple of weeks ago. The thing that's absent from your voice and absent from the tale you tell is bitterness, bitterness that could easily be there and rightfully be claimed. But I just think that's one of the signs that God really does have a hold of your life. So you know that God does, he does incredible things that we can't even see, we would never even ask for, to people that love and serve him. So you don't know what your future is, but I think it's going to be good. That's all I can say. I think it's going to be really good. And I think God's going to restore the years the locusts have eaten. So Derek, what's the best physical outcome here? Are you hoping for a pardon, and would that have to come from the president?
I am hopeful that the president will even consider. I'm appreciative that if he even takes a second out of his busy day to think about me or any of the guys who are at Leavenworth, more importantly, the other guys who are at Leavenworth, I'm home. If I get nothing else, I'm blessed enough. But my concern is for the guys who are still there, who don't get to enjoy time with their family, who can't hold their kids, whose moms are crying and stressing out every day for their sons. That's where my concern is. I hope that at some point, you know, there's more relief, that I can vote and I can own a firearm and, you know, carry myself like a normal human being, like a normal person without a felony conviction for murder hanging over my head. But honestly, I'm more worried about the guys who are still locked up and who are pending court martial than anything that happens to me. I'm blessed.
Derek, do people come to mind there by name whose stories you could tell us briefly, or at least one of them?
Absolutely. John Hatley is one of them. He is from Texas, dedicated first sergeant, fought in multiple wars, Army Ranger. I mean, just the epitome of what the Army builds as men, as warriors, as soldiers. And he was court-martialed for executing four Taliban that he had captured and who were placing IEDs in the road. The only problem is that the executions never happened. Basically, the army threatened two of the soldiers to testify against him, that he lined up four Taliban that they had captured, and the command had instructed him, because there wasn't enough evidence, to let go, that he took them out to a canal, got them down on their knees, fired four shots, and pushed their bodies into the ravine. They sent divers into the ravine, recovered no body. There was no fingerprints, no brass, no nothing physical to connect Hatley to these killings. Furthermore, they went to the villages where the families of the men he had supposedly killed were located. They knocked on the doors, asked the family, hey, can you tell us about whoever who was killed? These men that were executed. And they said, look, everybody's here. Do you want to see them? Our whole family is here. No one has been killed. No one is gone. And now
he's in Leavenworth.
Information, oh, now he's in Leavenworth. They continued to court-martial him. They went forward with the testimony of two soldiers who were threatened as being accessories to murder and were ultimately court-martialed themselves, who received reduced sentences.
Sergeant.
John Hatley is still sitting.
Yeah, John, that's just an incredible story. Sergeant Miller, thank you for your service and your kindness and the way you've let God work through you in spite of this. This is the epitome of injustice. So go to UAP.org, go to Justice for Warriors, and go to Derek Miller's Facebook page. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.